And we're back on Fictional Frontiers. What informs our perceptions of and about life? Those conclusions are often based on not only who or what is present in our lives, but also those people and things no longer with us. More importantly, we ask the question, can we ever have those things return? Or those people return, for that matter. Joan Huss, The Ones We're Meant to Find, is a layered science fiction novel about these very notions, set against the backdrop of a world ruined by ecological negligence. Joan, thanks again for taking the time. Welcome to Fictional Frontiers.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, Joan, I want to start by asking you about your approach to world or character building. And with respect to this novel, The Ones We're Meant to Find, can you pull back the layers there?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, when I was a kid, I really didn't think I was going to be a writer. I really was training to become a visual artist. So a lot of oil painting, pencil sketching, that was kind of all I really knew. And I was always, I loved reading as a kid, and I would like sneak reading when I was supposed to be painting. And I guess just being in the art field made me realize, like, with something as subjective and difficult as art and entertainment, you really need to be intrinsically motivated and not be doing it because of external validation, because it is so difficult. So I guess that's when I realized maybe my heart wasn't in the storytelling of visual art, because one of the reasons why I was doing it was because I felt like I was good at it, and like my peers and my teachers and my parents, they all thought I was a good artist, but again, like, that wasn't what I was doing when no one was looking. So I always loved reading, and then one day I watched the movie Spirited Away, which I loved for the animation and also the story and just the emotional impact it had on me, especially at the ending when I was, like, not ready to leave these characters behind. And I just decided on a whim to start writing, like, my own ending after the ending of that movie, and that became this really long piece of fan fiction. And that made me realize, like, this is the kind of art that I love. Like, I do love the image, the story that one image can tell, but I was like, what if I could tell a story via many images? And I kind of dabbled a bit in drawing my own mangas, actually, for that reason, because I was like, oh, like, I would love to tell a story via images, but I'm such a slow drawer that I was like, this isn't realistic, and it's easier for me to just write something. And so that's kind of how the transition for me happened. It just started from fan fiction, and then from there on, I eventually wondered, what if I started writing my own stories, and the rest of history.
And now we have these wonderful novels from you, and it's funny you bring up Spirited Away. I can definitely see some of the elements from Spirited Away in this novel, not necessarily with respect to, you know, the finer points of the story, but this notion of you don't know what you've got till it's gone, if I can borrow a line from an old Janet Jackson song. I'm dating myself here, but that's kind of what I thought of when you brought up Spirited Away, because without spoilers, it's really about losing things you maybe didn't really consider to be so important in your life and then trying to get those back. So there's definitely elements of that in The Ones We're Meant to Find. So let me ask you, with respect to the novel, it seems like it's a very personal and raw novel. Is that a fair take?
Yeah, I think with all my books, even though they are different from each other in genre and style, I do put a lot of myself into them. Maybe not necessarily like the characters are me, I wouldn't say that, but it's more like the dilemmas and the conflicts that are explored are ones that I think about a lot. And so, yeah, it definitely is personal, and I guess raw in that sense.
Well, let's talk about the story itself. The novel centers on two sisters, C and Casey. And first, let's talk about how they were together and then how, at the start of the novel, they've been pulled apart.
Yeah, so with the way the novel is structured, you only really see the way that these two sisters were together via their memories of each other and their respective point of views and flashbacks. And so the how they're pulled apart is kind of the center of the mystery and part of the twist. So they're endeavoring to find each other, and then slowly but surely you'll get to see what exactly happened that separated them and put one of them on this island, and another one is still in the floating city that they both used to live in.
Well, let's talk about the worlds they're inhabiting or the environments they're inhabiting right now. Obviously, we don't want to get into spoilers, but we find C on one place or in one place, and then we find Casey in another. And I was just fascinated by the, I guess you could say, echoes of what we're seeing today with respect to environmental negligence, as I mentioned at the outset, and how that really comes into play here. And as a matter of fact, I would argue that there are a lot of other elements related to this notion that, you know, materialism can replace or tries to replace these very personal bonds, so to speak, or these relationships we have with those we care about. So if you could talk about where C is and talk about where Casey is, and I know obviously there's a mystery underlying all this, but talk about these particular environments they're inhabiting right now.
Yeah, so C is, she's living on this abandoned island, and she's not sure how she got there, or and she has like very limited sense of memory. All she really remembers is that she has this sister who is somewhere across the ocean, and she has to find her. And this island is very primitive. Like, there is not really that much technology on it except for this one pretty useless android that she finds and this old house. Whereas Casey, she is living in this floating, technologically advanced city that protects its populace from this polluted, climate change-wrecked outside world. In exchange, in order for these cities to exist, the people living in them have to then conduct part of their lives virtually in order to reduce their environmental footprint and keep this way of living sustainable. And so, like you mentioned, there definitely is this theme of like materialism and kind of the ways that we live, even if we try to live our lives to the fullest or if we try to live with as many freedoms as we want, that might impact the people around us. And this is something, for me, when I'm building the world, it really kind of comes secondary to the plot and character. So a question I've been asked, like, oh, why did you pick to explore climate change? And, like, how did you think of the tech? And it really came about because of the inspiration I had for the plot and the twist and subsequently the characters. And then the kind of apocalyptic backdrop with climate change came after me deciding on the twist in the characters.
That's interesting. I was going to ask you that question because I didn't know whether or not it was the environment itself that kind of led to the story or vice versa. And that's good that you mentioned that, because one of the things I'm not saying I don't like, but one of the things I kind of find less, I guess you could say, original or maybe driven by market forces more than anything else is when you have like a checklist of items that you really kind of want to bring into a story. So you think, okay, well, this is what's popular today and this is what people want to read about. So I'm going to have a dystopian future. And what's, in the headlines now, it's the environment. So I'm just going to put that into the mix. And it seems like you actually, thankfully, and that's why it shines so strongly here, the characters and the story itself, you really focus on the themes, the elements of the relationships of the characters, and then you build the world around them. Is that right?
Yes, for sure. I don't know if you want me to delve into like kind of how the story came about and why.
Oh, that'd be great. Like, yeah, I'd love to hear that. Yeah. Because that's the most fascinating thing when we have a chance to talk about stories like this and talk about wonderful books like yours, is that we get to see the real sources of inspiration. Also, like I said, it's strong because it's not, color by numbers in its approach. And I can tell right from the beginning, as a matter of fact, when I started reading the book, I could tell that this was not something that was going down this well-beaten path. And that's very, very exciting when you've been doing a show like this for as long as we have, to be honest with you.
Thank you. I love twists. And I think part of that is because I'm such a slow writer that before I start embarking on anything, I kind of have to think, like, what is it that's going to make it different, right? Mm. Because someone else could write a story much faster than me. So if I'm going to take years on something, I'm like, how is it going to be something that's unique to me and something that hopefully readers have not seen before? So I guess, like, with the inspiration, it kind of starts with a bit of a cliche where I had this dream And I had this image in this dream of a girl diving to the bottom of the sea looking for something or someone. And I wasn't sure who she was looking for. And I started thinking about a lot of the books that I had read as a teen right around, like, the early 2010 period when, like, the young adult dystopian boom was happening.
Right, right.
And I absolutely love those books, like The Hunger Games, Divergent, Legend. Those books really got me into reading young adult. But because I read so many of them, I noticed there are some common, I guess not even tropes, but just craft devices.
Yes, exactly.
That were used in those books to kind of draw the reader in and get them to root for the main character. One of the things that I found really interesting was that a lot of these main characters, and I'll use Katniss because I feel like she's probably like one of the well-known examples, you have this main character that is very capable and goes on to accomplish these amazing feats, right? Like survive the Hunger Games or topple a dictatorship. And these are things that kind of seem superhuman and might make the character seem unrelatable to the average reader. But one of the ways I found that an author kind of introduces a character like that up front to make them more relatable, more empathetic, more vulnerable is oftentimes through a younger sibling relationship. So even though Katniss is doing these incredible things, you immediately from the get-go, you know she's doing it because she wants to protect her younger sister, Prim.
Right.
And that kind of is seen as humanizing the character. And because it's used, I feel like this device is used in multiple books, it kind of starts to say something about what kind of people we think deserve to be main characters, right? Like if a main character kind of has that self-sacrificial streak, that kind of makes them seem, again, more human, more empathetic, more vulnerable in our eyes, and in a way more deserving of undertaking this sort of great tale. And I just thought that was so interesting. So I was like, okay, what if I have this person who's looking for her sister? What if that sister is the younger sister? But the younger sister is so much more than a storytelling device. The younger sister is a character in her own right who kind of is a foil to see the older sister who's looking for her. She's a foil in the sense that she is missing a lot of the traits that we kind of associate automatically as, okay, this is our main character. And yet she is very human and empathetic in her own right. But I really wanted to challenge the idea of, like, who is relatable, who deserves to drive a story. So that's kind of where the inspiration for the entire story and particularly the twist came about. And then as for, like, the post-apocalyptic background, I kind of knew that for the plot that the sisters need to be separated because they need to find each other. So I was like, okay, what if the world is ending? And I thought, okay, like, what would be the main reason why the world is ending? And I wanted to pick something that would require readers to suspend the least amount of disbelief, because the story isn't necessarily about that aspect. It's
right.
about, like, this friendship and what you would do to help someone else live and what you would do to live yourself. So I was like, okay, definitely not going to be something like aliens, right,
mm-hmm.
or zombies, because they need to do a lot of explanation. But for me, I guess climate change just popped up as, like, the most intuitive reason as to why the world might be ending in the near future. So that's kind of how that aspect got woven in, and it ended up working out well, because I think it does mirror a lot of the questions and dilemmas that the characters themselves face, where you have this choice of, like, between the right to live and the right to freedom. And I think, again, like, the climate change crisis poses these questions as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. And it's funny you bring up the contrast between the two characters, and that leads me to not just them, but also the way the society kind of defines one's worth or status. And I think it's interesting, particularly given a lot of the political discourse today, that we talk about the sins of the past, right, and how we should or should not address those. And here you definitely address them head on as far as the ranking of individuals in a society and where they fall in to this hierarchy. So talk about that, because, again, it's a very fresh take, and I know you weren't pulling necessarily from what's happening in modern times, but, you know, you can't help but see the parallels there.
Yeah, I think, so, like, the ranking thing in, like, the initial draft, I knew that people living in Casey's world and these protected floating eco-cities, I knew that they would have to be admitted based on, I guess, something that is directly relevant to the climate crisis, right? So even though obviously there is overlap between like your economic status, like your socioeconomic position, and how many things you can do to protect the environment and the climate, I wanted to make the ranking system specific to like what you are doing to protect the planet. So that aspect was always there. As for how I then developed, like later on in revisions, I was trying to fine tune this and make it a bit more unique. And I was thinking, well, in terms of environmental damage, like a lot of the kind of repercussions that we're facing today aren't necessarily just created by us, right? Like all these things are caused, especially in the climate crisis, like a lot of the things are caused by things that we've done 50, 100 years ago. And so how would we then account that into a rank? And when I was thinking about this, I actually got back to like my Chinese fantasy roots, because my first book was this Chinese kind of historical fantasy, and something that when you look at Chinese history, you'll see that a lot of times, like if you committed treason against the emperor, the punishment would not only be like you would get off, but they would kill like everyone within like 9 relationship ranks to you. So like your distant aunts and your like your second cousins, they would all be killed if you did something bad, and that was supposed to serve as a deterrent in that kind of society, especially because familial bonds and like your relationships are so highly valued that even if you don't value your own life, most people would be deterred by the thought of your entire clan being killed if you did something wrong. So I was thinking, okay, that definitely is an interesting aspect. So I was like, okay, like what if I use that so that not only is it you, like not when you, I guess like if you're thinking like, oh, I'm just going to pollute and I'm just going to like do something bad, like not only are you affecting your own ranking, you'd be affecting like your children's and your grandchildren's rankings. And certainly there are a lot of people who might not think as far ahead and care about that, but I was thinking like, okay, in this society they probably want to reward the people who are able to think that far ahead. And yet I do think it is, like I don't want to say that this is the way to go, because I think the book clearly also shows that this is a flawed system, because again, even though the rank itself says that it only takes into account how committed you are to planetary protection, there is so much overlap between how much a person can do and is capable of doing and where they are in life, right? Because if you're struggling just to sustain yourself, you might not even have like the privilege and the capability of thinking as far as, am I going to be, you know, cursing or putting my future children in a disadvantaged state when you're not even in a state to think about that.
Most definitely. And that's why I love this book, because there's so many layers here. And even with the characters themselves, they have certain secrets that kind of inform their progress and how they move through the various challenges or address the various challenges they're facing. So talk about that as well, because we all have secrets, and they definitely come into play with respect to not only how we look at ourselves, but how we look at our relationships with others.
Yeah, I think, I guess what draws me to like characters with secrets is oftentimes that, especially I think in relationships where characters do love each other and care about each other, and yet they still keep secrets, I find that so fascinating, because I think a lot of times you can want the best for someone and want to protect them and want to help them, and yet it's precisely because of that that you end up hurting them, because you might think you know best for them, or you might decide things on their behalf, or you might try to protect them, and then the ways you kind of go about that might be very different from someone else who kind of has the same end goal, but like again, the approach I feel like everyone has to how they love someone, how they connect to someone, is so different. And so I guess that's why like the characters, especially the sisters, in this book, they do keep these secrets from each other that end up being hurtful, even though it doesn't come from a place of intentionally wanting to hurt. And this is also something that I explore my debut, and I think I explore in every book. I realize that this is a common theme, because I think it's easy to have like a villainous or like antagonistic relationship be such a way that like there are these secrets that are kept for the purposes of betrayal and of sabotage and hurting someone. But I think it's so much more fascinating when, again, these hurtful actions, well, not even hurtful actions, these consequences that end up hurting come from a place of good intention.
It's very interesting, you know, going through the trials and tribulations involving the pandemic. I can tell you my son, he's been doing a lot of work online. He's working virtually. And even though he's connected with so many people, as we all are, he seems to be more isolated than ever before. So it's, you know, always interesting to see how works like yours, which come from one place, if they are filled with a lot of imaginative energy, you can actually, you know, reflect on a lot of different things, even though the intent was not there as far as the author was concerned. So kudos to you for that.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned that, because that was actually my goal. Like, I wanted to make Casey seem kind of as marooned as C, even though, like you said, Casey, she is in this high population density, probably even denser, I'd say, than New York City,
right,
sort of environment. Yeah.
Not because Philly, New York. Think, we got to say New York, right?
Yeah. Because I think, and I think that's kind of where I was, what I was saying when, in terms of like my world building, a lot of like the world building choices were made in service of the characters, because I really wanted, even though I knew I was putting C on like this abandoned island with literally no one around, I wanted her to crave this connection so much that it almost feels like that she's like, she has like just as much company as Casey. It's not more, right? Like, I would say C with Yumi, the android, and even just like the way she interacts with like the boats she's building and the way she approaches life, even though she is alone, because she craves that connection, she makes it for herself. Where, and I think that's highlighted by the fact that she is alone. And the same thing kind of goes for Casey, where she is surrounded by people, but she makes deliberate choices that kind of cut her off from the people around her in her environment, because that's what she wants as a character, right? And so that's kind of also highlighted, because she is in this very crowded environment where it's almost impossible like walk outside without brushing shoulders with someone, and yet she makes these choices, for example, to spend as much of her time like in the stasis pod, conducting her life virtually as possible. And she makes choices to kind of skip school, to kind of avoid connecting with people, and that is so unique to her character. And she's kind of making the statement in this setting that she is in, where I feel like most people aren't like her.
Oh yeah, that's so true. And it's funny, as you're kind of explaining the thought processes behind this, I keep thinking about so many kids like my son who in many respects were stuck at home because of the pandemic, right? And everything was being experienced virtually, and you know, how that impacts people's psyche and how that impacts people's development. And you know, and you could argue that even though they're connected online, they're more alone than they've ever been. People are. And the pandemic kind of really shined the light on that in even greater, or with greater intensity, I should say. And it's interesting. Like I said, when novels are coming from a pure place, I find that all these wonderful themes kind of come from the seeds that are planted. So it's great that even though maybe you didn't intend it, obviously you weren't writing about the pandemic when you were writing the novel, but it's interesting how when it comes from a pure place, you can kind of bring themes that are happening, or you know, things that are relevant presently into you know, your analysis or the emotional resonance that you're grappling with when reading a book like this.
Yeah, for sure. And it's funny because you mentioned it, because I had drafted the book in 2017, so well before the pandemic. But I was actually putting like the finishing touches on revision right before the start of the pandemic. And then I remember in like March, I saw that news about how the atmosphere had cleared up a bit via satellite images, because so many people were staying inside.
Right.
Like,
yeah,
oh no, this
that.
Is like, this is like hitting way too close to the book. So yeah, it's definitely both. I guess it's like disturbing, but also it does make me feel like things like this, like the pandemic and climate change, they are so similar and parallel to each other, mm-hmm. in the sense that it requires this collective kind of action to address anything.
What about the notion of family? What were you trying to say, or are you trying to say anything with this novel?
It's funny because I think every book of mine, again, focuses on like a family relationship. Like in Descendant of the Crane, my debut, it's very much focused on this daughter-father relationship, mm-hmm. even though there are also siblings in that. And then in this one, obviously sisters, and in the next book, it's like something else. And I guess the way I approach that is I don't really think of it as like, oh, a sister relationship is different from a father-daughter relationship, even though they are clearly different. Instead, again, I approach it from this view of, in these family relationships, I think at the end of the day, the characters, they do want the best for each other, and there is this element of sort of unconditional love, mm-hmm. that runs through these relationships, at least in the ones that I choose to portray. But it becomes more heartbreaking because, again, two people can want the same things, but just by approaching them differently, it can lead to vastly different results, right? And so that's honestly, I guess that's what I'm trying to say, not just for family relationships, but for all our relationships, where it's not enough to just be working towards something together. The approach also matters. And yet I wouldn't say that everyone should be aligning like their approach is the same, because I think that's also kind of like the beauty and tragedy of just yes. life in general, is that we all do want different things. And even when we do want the same things, are just who we are creates these different approaches. And that's what gives life interest, but also it also is what creates conflict.
Yes. Yes. It's like the notion you can't know pleasure without pain, right? That's, you know, it's you know, it's better to have loved and lost than never have loved at all. I guess that's another way to put it.
Yeah.
Well, two good questions as we head out. One, the romance in here. How hard was that to kind of, I'm not saying shoehorn, because it's obviously a very important part of the story, but you've got all these different thematic elements floating about, and you've got this wonderful, I don't want to say wonderful environment, because you got multiple environments, but you've got this incredible world building at work here. Was that more challenging, less challenging? How did you incorporate all that?
Yeah, I think definitely when I'm writing, I feel like my romance is kind of, they're not shooed in the sense, but definitely like, I feel like a lot of times my characters are kind of more stressed by like other problems than their romantic relationships. So it's definitely something that I feel like I'm like, oh, like as I'm revising, I'm like, should I add it more? And then like, oh, but there's no space. Like literally see at some points, I think she literally says to herself, like, I cannot be distracted by this. I have something else I need to do. And this romance is, it's not only like kind of taking away my time. It's actively detracting from me going mm-hmm. to accomplish my goals, which I feel like probably is something that I experienced as a teen, where I was like really stressed out in school and like way too focused on other things. But it was, I guess for Seed in this case, like the island sort of romance that happens, it was a bit more, just easier to write because there is a bit more space for that. I think in Casey's point of view, that's where it was kind of more difficult to write. I wouldn't even say it was like a romance until like the later parts of the book, but mm-hmm. it was more difficult to write this relationship she had with her respective, I guess, boy, because they both have such strong agendas that really would, like, if they had to kill each other to, like, make their what they want come true, to make what they want happen, I feel like they would, which is, I guess, sometimes, like, it is what readers like. It's kind of like that enemies trope that we sometimes see in young adult, mm-hmm. but it definitely isn't played out to, like, that full extent, because, again, I personally have a hard time kind of carving out that narrative space to give as much weight to the romance as the plot.
No, and I'm glad you didn't, like I said, kind of follow the paint-by-numbers approach there either. And again, that's not the way romance really works anyway, right? It's not a, I mean, it's not the picket fence and the, you know, the White House and the, you know, one cat, one dog kind of thing going on here. It's much more complicated than that. And like you said, there are all these other elements that come into play that maybe don't allow you to kind of focus on those elements. It's not just, it's not this idealized realization that we think that is going to be the case when we get to the end of the rainbow, so to speak.
Yeah.
Well, as we head out, Joan, just one other question, actually two questions. One, if you had to approach someone with the novel and you said, listen, they've never read any of your books before, they're not really into YA, they're not really into science fiction, how would you present The Ones We're Meant to Find to them? It's not the elevator pitch. I don't want to put the pressure on you here, but how would you, if you were saying, look, yeah, I'm an author and I've got this story that I want to share, how would you, you know, share that introduction with them?
Yeah, I guess like not elevator pitch, but I always like if I encounter someone who maybe hasn't read that much science fiction, I feel like a lot of times we might like watch more science fiction, so I definitely would plug Black Mirror first. I'd be like, if you like seeing explorations of how humanity and tech intersect and how tech itself isn't good or bad, but instead what, how we interact with it that places this kind of value judgment on a piece of technology, I think if anyone's interested in that, I would say give The Ones We're Meant to Find a try. For people who love big twists and being surprised, I guess also, like you mentioned, kind of Spirited Away is definitely like a huge influence on me. I would say, like, if you enjoyed, you know, Ghibli films, I also would recommend it, because even though it is like sci-fi, there is I didn't really necessarily want to be constrained by like the science research and the world building. I wanted there to be kind of a surreal element too, because there are quite a lot of dream and memory scenes in the book.
Yes.
And so that plus the environmental aspect, I think, would appeal to fans of Studio Ghibli. But yeah, that would probably be how I pitch the book to someone who maybe isn't as into reading young adult or sci-fi.
I think that's a perfect way to present it. And not to name drop here, but I actually had the opportunity to meet Miyazaki sensei about 8 years ago. No, was it maybe 9 years ago? He was visiting San Diego Comic-Con promoting Ponyo, was what he was there for. And I actually got him to sign something for me. So I actually have something signed from Miyazaki sensei. So I had the name drop. And that's the only person I've ever asked for an autograph from, as far as anyone in you know, these mediums. And that's, you know, over 10 years of conducting interviews and hosting this show, I've only asked for one autograph, and it was from him. So I thought it was worth it. I don't feel guilty about that.
It's definitely worth it. Worth the autograph. I'm so jealous.
Well, Joan, as we head out, number one, where can our listeners keep abreast of you on the web? And I know you mentioned another novel you're working on, so let's talk about that as we head out.
Yeah, you can find me at my website is jonesmewrites.com, and my handle for everything, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, is also at jonesmewrites. As for my next book, it's hopefully going to be this low fantasy that's set in the mountains, and it also has a really big twist in it, and it explores my personal feelings on the immigrant experience being like a second generation Chinese American here and the diaspora experience. And I'm also hoping to return to Chinese fantasy soon, actually. That's one of my first true loves. So fingers crossed, I'll have something about that soon, too.
The Ones We're Meant to Find. Joan, you're always welcome back on Fictional Frontiers. Thank you so much for sharing this amazing novel. And one of our other friends, Hafsa Faisal, actually mentioned your novel, and that's how we kind of found out about it. So
oh my god,
kudos,
I love
Hafsa. Hafsa
is a great friend. Yeah.
So
thank you so much for having me. This is so much fun.
No worries, and thank you, Hafsa, if you're listening, for making the intro.
Hi there, this is James Arnold Taylor, voice actor. For those of you unfamiliar with the title voice actor, it means simply someone that acts with their voice, that does the voice of animated characters for cartoons, video games, TV, radio, movie trailers, promos, commercials, phone services, internet, basically anywhere you hear a voice telling you something but don't see the person, that's a voiceover done by, hopefully, a voice actor. Now, I've been using my voice to entertain, inform, and make a living now for over 25 years, and I wouldn't change it for the world. I'm the voice of many famous characters, such as
Fred Flintstone, Yabba Dabba Doo,
Obi-Wan Kenobi,
11-year-old Johnny Test, awesome!
To name a few, as well as the voice that tells you about
Animation Domination coming up next on Fox.
1,000 Ways to Die on Spike TV.
I'm a Frosted Miniweed, and many famous video game characters, including Ratchet from Ratchet & Clank,
Gabe Logan from Siphon Filter,
and Tidus from Final Fantasy X. It's a living that can be fun, but also a lot of hard work, as with anything. And for those of you that heard my first segment last month here on Fictional Frontiers, you know that voice acting is something just about everyone wants to do. And today, I'd like to address that in a different way than last time. See, I gave a perspective then that could come off almost frustrated by all the attention I get when I mention what I do and how most people want me to help them do what I do. And while it can at times feel like a thankless position to be in, I must say that I am beyond grateful for the work I do daily, as it's been my dream since I was about 4 years old. And at that age, I had many great voice actors to look up to, namely Mel Blanc, Don Messick, Dawes Butler, Gary Owens, and Paul Frees. As I grew up and voice acting became a greater part of the entertainment world through Saturday morning cartoons, I found new heroes to add to my list, such as Jim Cummings, Frank Welker, Casey Kasem, Rob Paulsen, Maurice LaMarche, Billy West, Michael Bell, Peter Cullen, and Corey Burton. I'm proud to say that they're all now people I call friends and get to work with them regularly, alongside other contemporaries of mine like D. Bradley Baker, Tom Kane, Jess Harnell, Cree Summer, Tara Strong, Bob Bergen, Jeff Bennett, Phil Lamar, Tom Kenny, John DiMaggio, Kevin Michael Richardson, Gray Delisle, Richard Horowitz, Jennifer Hale, Nika Futterman, Stephen Stanton, Tress McNeil, Yuri Lowenthal, Will Friedle, Charlie Schlatter, Darren Norris, Candy Milo, David Kay, Jason Marsden, and the list goes on and on. It's truly difficult to add everyone I'd like to, and please forgive me if I neglected to add your favorite name. But something I would say about all these amazing actors, and please note, these are amazing actors, not just people that do funny voices. They are all extremely humble, kind, and giving to other performers and to fans. They've shown a grace, humility, and excitement for the craft that goes far beyond what you find in most of the mainstream sources of Hollywood performers. Maybe it's the fact that they never really get the limelight and attention. Maybe it's just sheer coincidence. However, I think not. I believe at the core, they're all people like me that truly love and believe in the beauty of storytelling and creating characters more so than getting attention that feeds their egos. Now, that's not a judgment on on-camera actors as much as an acknowledgement of the art of voice acting. To be a successful voice actor, you can't have an ego because, quite frankly, there's no room for it in the little padded booths they put us in. And there's no room for it in the craft of voice acting. To act using only your voice, your inflections, tones, enunciations, characterizations, accents, it takes a different part of the brain, a different part of the actor. If you don't believe me, just ask any on-camera actor that has come in and seen how different it is in a voice session as opposed to a film or TV set with cameras, crews, makeup, costumes, trailers, and fruit platters. A voice actor doesn't get into acting to make millions. They do it, again, for the love of performing in one of the purest forms out there. We all understand that there are no award shows for us, no accolades, very few magazine articles, Access Hollywood segments, or even behind-the-scenes bonus features of us on the DVDs or Blu-rays of the movies and shows we're in. Now, Hollywood usually saves that for the big-name celebrities that come in and lend their name and voice. It's a job for someone that is dedicated and flexible. Someone with the ability to have no inhibitions about sounding as though they've just been lit on fire. And now they have to run and scream. Yelling through a plate glass window. Oh, that's sharp. And fall through their death. Or when they hit the ground.
Oh, back up. Woo! Laughing at the thought of it all. Ooh, that kind of tickled. Yeah.
To be putty in the director's hands, to give several different reads of the same line, each one with its own unique tone, inflection, and meaning. Each one with its own unique tone, inflection, and meaning.
Each one with its own unique tone, inflection, and meaning.
To be a voice actor, you have to be ready to read anything, anywhere, anytime, and make it sound as though it's coming out of you as naturally as you would say your own name. To get a script as you're walking in the door of a recording session, and by the time you enter the booth a few steps later, you are ready to record it and have it heard by millions for years to come and possibly become part of history. There's no time to become the character, to memorize the dialogue, or to even find little nuances in the performance, although all good voice actors seem to find it as they go. So to all of you that have always wanted to become a voice actor because you were inspired by one of the amazing talents that I've already mentioned, or one that slipped past my radar, I say thank you. Thank you for seeing, or more specifically, hearing all the work that goes so unnoticed by so many every day. You know, I doubt Hollywood will ever admit that they, in fact, need the voice actor and our flexible nature. But I know that through my Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter pages, you're all out there, and the real audience is listening. Lesson 2. Is it cold in here, or is it just what I'm reading? Now, as I mentioned, a voice actor rarely has time to prepare. With most work these days, there are non-disclosure agreements, or NDAs as we call them, for just about everything we do, which keeps us from getting to read the scripts in advance. So, when you're interviewed, a fan asks, or frankly even your spouse or family asks, "So what are you working on?" You basically have to smile and say, "I can't tell you." Which can come off a little rude, especially with your spouse. Yikes. Fact is, if you're a voice actor that doesn't have at least one project that you're working on currently that you can't talk about, well, you're not working enough. Video games, animated TV shows, movies, internet pieces, radio and TV commercials make you sign paperwork that says you will not give anything away, even during the auditioning process nowadays. Everyone is keeping secrets, and those secrets can come back to bite you right in the voiceover booth if you're not good at cold reading. What do I mean by cold reading? Well, I don't mean cold like... Although it does get pretty chilly in most studios. On a side note, the last Final Fantasy video game I did, which is already released so I can talk about it without danger of a lawsuit, I hope, it was so cold in the booth, my teeth were literally chattering between takes. And I had to do a bunch of jumping up and down to try and warm myself up. They had blankets for me, a space heater, I had 3 layers on, long sleeve shirt, sweater, and a jacket. That was a cold studio, and a cold reading in every sense of the term. In the voiceover world, cold reading means that you've never seen the script before reading it in the booth. And on games like Final Fantasy, for example, the scripts are usually the size of a mid-sized town phone book. Lots of dialogue, for lots of different combinations. If my character turns right, I say, this. Turns left, this. Goes forward, this. Goes backwards, this. I really credit the writers and creators of these games and virtual worlds. It's amazingly complex stuff, and the key to the voice actor's job is to make it all sound easy, even if half the time we have no idea of what we're actually talking about. Oh, and please, don't get me started on names of characters. Titus, Titus, Titanium, who knows? But you better pronounce it right when you're reading it in the game. So, how do we do it? How do voice actors walk into the room with a script they've never seen before and act out the parts in a way that sounds like it's their words and not the brilliant writers? The same way you get to Carnegie Hall. Practice, man. Practice. When you're starting out in voice work, you've got to get used to lots of things, like we talked about last time, hearing your own voice, but also reading things for the first time like it's the 101st time. I've always enjoyed reading things out loud and trying to make them sound compelling, dramatic, exciting, etc. Some words pour out the drama as they drop from your tongue, like Shakespeare.
But soft, what light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun.
Others, well, you might have to fight to make them sound interesting.
Stereo speaker installation. Waltz connecting the left and right speaker interfaces. One must be certain to make the connections properly. For if the cords are not firmly plugged in, No sound shall pass!
Either way, you as the performer have to make it sound easy, free-flowing, and of course, entertaining. So, if you're a fellow student of The Voice and wanting to make a career in the profession of voice acting, well then, my friend, reading out loud, colder than winter in the Antarctic, is what you must learn to do. You've got to go into it knowing that you're not going to know what's coming next, and you have to be able to read ahead of what you're actually reading. In other words, as I read this sentence out loud, in my head, I'm reading ahead by several words by what you're hearing coming out of my mouth. So, I know if there's going to be a difficult word or name coming up and preparing my tongue to do some vocal acrobatics. How do you get your mind able to do this? How do you prepare your tongue for twists and turns without a collision with a marvelously magnificent amalgamation of meanings and words? Sorry, couldn't find a word that started with M that meant word. Well, personally, I like Dr. Seuss. Well, actually, personally, I love Dr. Seuss. He was one of the finest wordsmiths out there, and his books are some of the best ways to get used to not just hearing your voice and experimenting with characters, but also to learn how to prepare your brain to see a jumble of words unbumble without a stumble, crumble, or rumble. So learn to be numble. Damn it, nimble. Go to the library and check out some Seuss. Read it out loud till your tongue needs a masseuse. Don't look ahead in the pages you read. Say it quite fast or you run out of speed. Read it with meaning, with spirit, with fun. By the end of the book, all the words will be done. But not over, not finished, not quite, not at all. You've got more to read, now let's stay on the ball. I find reading books like The Cat in the Hat are fun, entertaining, but there's much more than that. There's a Walkett in my pocket now, that one's quite good. But if you can, you should read about where the Lorax once stood. Or, of course, there's no Seuss without green eggs and ham. Just make sure you read it out loud, Sam I Am. If you're looking to make some noise, here's what to do. Just pick up a copy of Mr. Brown Can Moo. Can you? Not hearing all the words that you speak when you read? Then ask Horton the Elephant to remedy your need. They're all entertaining, they're all the tops. Like Fox in Socks and Hop on Pops. I could name them all, but you get the point. They help you read cold and your tongue they anoint. You know, I find reading Seuss gives me more than just words to read. It's happy, it's inspiring, it's full of life and flavor, and that's what you should feel about everything you read when you're a voice actor. So use it to instill positive thought patterns for your day-to-day work as a performer, because again, while I think of myself as the luckiest man in the world to get to be all these cool characters and tell you that
The Simpsons is coming up next on Fox,
I also know it's much more than that, and at times it can become like any other job, just something you do. That is, if you let it become that. In fact, I would say to anyone that is doing any job, whether it be a voice actor or ringing up an order at the local burger joint, you've got to find a way to love it and be grateful for it. Because there's so much to be grateful for in having the ability to use your God-given nature and body to perform a task. I've learned through many years of hard work, but also through a time when I was without my voice and the prospect of it not coming back to its full potential, that you gotta love what you got and use it in the most joyous ways you can. I also learned in that time that you can accomplish anything if you keep your focus on it and be willing to fail, flail, wail, but always stay on target with a goal of success. You can become a voice actor if you truly desire it and truly are ready to go through the fire. It's not as easy a profession as it looks and people think. It's a small group that makes it because it's a small group that really has taken the time to love and nourish their gifts and abilities in this craft. These are the folks I was referring to earlier, and they can all pick up anything and read it without ever seeing it before in whatever way the director asks. No stumbling or bumbling, just reading, and most importantly, acting. Yes, it does require acting to read something cold and make it believable. I personally think it requires a greater skill of acting to do so than having a script committed to memory and rehearsed over the course of days, weeks, or months. Now, that's not to say that I think that type of acting isn't remarkable as well. Let me say, look, I love on-camera acting, and I truly admire most of the big names that you see in Hollywood today for their craft. I simply wish Hollywood admired or at least acknowledged voice actors for the craft they display moment by moment. In fact, isn't it kind of crazy that while many don't believe what the voice actor does takes skill, it's the voice actor's job to voice all the trailers and promos for all the movies and TV shows that feature the quote-unquote real actors and sell you, the public, on seeing them? So, what else can you read out loud without looking? Anything and everything. Comic books are good if you want to get into animation and video games and do characters and voices.
the newspaper, or online news articles and books if you want to do narration. Read the ads out loud in the magazines you read if you want to work in the commercial area of voiceover. You can read any and all words that you see and try messing yourself up. Open a book on your shelf and just begin reading without knowing the context and see if by the end of the sentence you know where you're at and what you're actually talking about and if you've made it sound real. Now, how do you know if you're doing it right? Well, record yourself as much as you can reading these things again and again. Get used to hearing yourself and telling yourself that you're good at what you do and that you can be the best at it if you apply yourself. I personally get up every morning and say to myself, I believe I can make a difference in this world today with all that I do and all that I say. Now, as a voice actor, all that I say is pretty much all that I do, so they feed into each other. But they also help me see that there is truly a lot of information out there that needs to be conveyed to a perplexed and confused world.
And it is the job of the voice actor to read it, no matter how short the line of copy.
Member FDIC.
Or just plain boring.
Offer expires November 30th. See store for details.
I can and will do my best to love it and read it with emotion, compassion, and dexterity of tongue, even if I've never seen it before.
And if I've done my job right, you will never know it. Hey, thanks so much for taking the time to hear me here at Fictional Frontiers. I hope it's informative, inspiring, and entertaining. I know I have fun with it. Also, please know you can visit me, James Arnold Taylor, at my website, www.jamesarnoldtaylor.com, and click on the Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube links to follow me, or watch my one-man stage show about voiceover. I hope to get as many people as possible to see the half-hour version of it on YouTube to start spreading the word so I can then take the full version on the road and show more of the world what it really means to act using only your voice. I hope you join me there as well so I can inspire you and in turn the rest of the world by staying positive and focused on all that this amazing life has to offer us in the greatest time in history for technology and connectivity. You know, we can achieve more than we ever thought possible if we believe we can and do it. I'm James Arnold Taylor, and I believe in you. Thanks for your time, and God bless.
This show was written, voiced, recorded, and produced by James Arnold Taylor for Fictional Frontiers. All commentaries and opinions were those of James Arnold Taylor and are not necessarily reflective of Fictional Frontiers. All written and spoken materials are owned and copyrighted by James Arnold Taylor, Yumigo, Inc., 2011. All music and sound effects libraries were used with permissions.
Twilight like the dawn.